Bill 280-6 amendments. As you all recall, this is the credit scoring bill with regard to the use of credit scores in insurance rating and underwriting. I have worked with a number of the interested parties on these amendments, and they've obviously gone through quite a number of revisions. The Dash 6 amendments are a complete gut and stuff of the bill to make it easy for you to read where all the changes are. But the operable parts that you will be most interested in start on page 9. At the bottom, you'll find subsection 5, which describes when there is an adverse underwriting decision, what needs to be advised to the consumer about the underwriting decision. It is limited to credit reasons. And there has to be a description of what credit reasons were used for the adverse underwriting decision. What is an adverse underwriting decision is defined in the beginning of the bill. It does not include placement with an affiliate insurer. Then the actual credit, the credit scoring can be used in underwriting decisions, but it's limited. And the limitations start on page 11. In the middle, line 15, you'll see subsection A. You cannot use the absence of a credit history. What that means is for individuals who don't have a credit history either because they've had all their debts paid off, they don't use credit cards, they don't have a mortgage, or for other reasons, you cannot use the simple absence of credit history against them. If you'll see B at the bottom of page 11, credit inquiries not initiated by the consumer. Those are the credit card offers you all get in the mail. Each one of those is it begins with a credit score check, and those appear on your credit score, and those cannot be used against you as long as they're not initiated by you. If you look on page 12 at the top, you can also not use credit inquiries from insurance companies or from mortgage industry lenders. On sub E on line 6 of page 12, multiple lender inquiries from the automobile industry cannot be used. Sub F on line 9 of page 12, a consumer's total available credit cannot be used. So when you get one of those letters from your credit card company saying that they just gave you $100,000 in free credit because you're such a good customer, that cannot be used against you. Two things that you will notice that aren't in this bill now are we've removed the medical debt issue because it seemed unworkable, and that was the recommendation that you cannot use medical debts as... If somebody fails to pay a medical debt, you can't use that against them because it might impact their credit. The problem is most medical debts are not properly coded, I've been advised. So you can't just look at a credit report and tell what is and what is not a medical debt. Specifically, if you paid for a prescription with your Visa card and you didn't pay off the Visa bill, it would be a medical debt, but it wouldn't be coded as such because the debt would be to Visa and not to Kaiser or your HMO. The other thing that we removed is the type of credit card the person was using. That seemed odd. Essentially, it was saying the only way it was explained to me was whether you had a gold card, a platinum card, a Target card, and that seemed unworkable as well, so that was removed. So that's the compromise that's represented in the Dash 6 of Senate Bill 280.
All right. Senator Ringo, you have some comments, correct?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These compromises were worked out among various of the insurance industry representatives to satisfy their various concerns based on the assumption that the goal was to say that you could use credit only during initial underwriting but not during renewals, but there's a lot of other issues that pertain to how it shall be used that I don't really think have been worked out. And even though the work group may have come to the decision among themselves, I don't think they necessarily worked with the advocates for consumers on this. And just as one example, yesterday I had a meeting with a number of the folks, and apparently there's still an open issue as to whether renewal means that, let's say somebody was initially given a very, very favorable credit score, and therefore a low premium, then on the re-rating, they didn't have as good a credit score. I guess the assumption is that then it would be assumed they had a neutral credit rating. And that neutral credit rating could still be used then to increase their premium. And that's the interpretation that I think some of the industry folks have, and it's certainly not my understanding that's the way we should go, because I think that still means that on re-rating there would be the premium could go up because of credit. And so I'm a little disappointed because I don't think we have come to a resolution on this. Mm-hmm. There still are open-ended questions. And then on top of that, there are some other issues in here that I think we still need to work on the language in a couple areas that I think are pretty important.
All right. Insurance lobby. You guys want to stand up? Because I'm dead serious. I'm losing patience on this issue. And so Tuesday of next week, we're going to run either a compromise bill that the insurance industry supports, or we're going to run the ban. So, you know, have it your way. But I think that the lack of the insurance industry's ability to come to some reasonable agreement here is troubling, not only to this committee, but I think there's a clear majority for the committee that would vote for a ban, but I think that the insurance industry's dragging of their feet in this instance is not going to bode well in the House of Representatives either. So I'm saying this very stern message to you because I'm dead serious. I don't like the fact that we have not come to a conclusion. So Tuesday next week, we're running one or the other. So either we have a compromise or we don't. Other members have comments? John, you can sit down. Sorry. None of the other insurance industry people would stand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to endorse the comments that the chairman made. I was approached 3 or 4 weeks ago with very optimistic news that agreements have been reached, and now they seem to be fraying around the edges. On the point about going that was brought up about using renewal, being able to use bad declining credit ratings on renewal, to me that goes against the intent of what I was told people were trying to do, which was to use be able to use the credit rating as an underwriting factor when you're bringing in business, but then it is no longer a factor in any way whatsoever on renewal or to raise rates upon renewal or to cancel on renewal. To me, to be kind of backsliding now and saying, well, we want to switch them to a neutral rate, well, that raises their rates. If you're going to do that, then if somebody's credit improves on renewal, then you need to give them a better rate, and then you've defeated the whole purpose of the measure, which is to take credit out of the factor, once out of the mix, once you've written the business. And for the insurance industry, if you're going to be able to charge higher rates for less than ideal credit at the beginning, and live with that and keep those rates going, theoretically, even if a person's credit improves, which it sometimes does, then you've got to go the other way too. So just on that one point, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to send a strong message that I do not think that was the intent of what I heard a couple of weeks ago, and certainly something I'm able to support in this bill.
Okay. Any comments, Senator Farrell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This issue is before the committee because citizens and agents, let me make that clear, feel that there's a fairness issue here, and they don't like the idea that credit reporting is used in a discriminatory way in rating. That played itself out in the rules, the administrative rules that were discussed and adopted by the insurance commissioner, and that is wholly inadequate address the issues. People have not been satisfied. And I have the sense, I think, that I share with the chairman that this is damage control and issues management, and that's being practiced by the underwriters in the industry. It's failed. This set of compromises is just a cloud of detail that no citizen will be able to discern and understand and follow. You can look at this law. We have no idea how this will play out in actual practices. I think most underwriters will agree that it's so Byzantine and complex that, there's plenty of loopholes in this thing. Agents will be told by their agencies to, probably to change their current practices not a little, not even a little. And citizens will still be subjected to what I think is a happenstance. There's a statistical correspondence, and that's being turned into a behavioral model. And I'm not so sure that that is good science or any science. It seems to me to be coincidental science. Bottom line for me is that I still don't see anything. Nobody's assured me that a simple number of inquiries won't result in increases in premiums wholly unrelated to any behavior other than credit reports being filed on a person. That's just wrong. I'm very happy to wait and see under the chairman's direction if a compromise can be reached. It should be a very simple matter of saying that a credit rating and credit report has a perfectly legitimate place in the decision-making process about how to extend credit, whether or not the payment terms are premiums in advance, semi-annually, quarterly, or monthly. And because that is a legitimate decision about extending credit. That is the use of a credit report. Any other use is prejudicial. I'll look for a compromise that uses a credit report in the process for which it was intended, and that's to make a decision about the creditworthiness of the individual. If anything else is there, I won't support it. So I just am hoping that a compromise provides clarity and simplicity and not more obfuscation, which is what the Dash 6 is in.
All right. Senator Walker, comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the comments here this morning, and I told the parties I was amenable to a compromise, but we aren't here, and this morning I learned from our learned counsel that all that crap we get in the mail for credit goes against our credit score. That was brand new knowledge to me this morning. I think we have an underlying problem here with the whole credit system, the Fair Isaac system, and all that black box that we heard so much about. And it's too bad we can't get to that element, but at least we can protect citizens when they go to obtain insurance in the use of these credit scores. So I'm looking forward to Tuesday as well.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to close the work session on 280, and on Tuesday we'll have both 260 in its original form and 280 with theoretically some amendments that the committee can agree on. With that, we're going to close the work session, and we're going to then transition. Thank you. And Justice Carson is here on Senate Bill 882. Justice Carson, if you would like to come forward, and I apologize for the delay, but a little housekeeping.
Chair, may I bring Judge Dan Ahern from Jefferson and Cook Counties, who's going to shepherd the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, while Chief is getting seated, this bill deals with adjudication and disposition of delinquency cases involving a Warm Springs youth or youth offender, and would allow for a memorandum of understanding to be entered into by the presiding judge of the judicial district and the Warm Springs tribe on how to deal with those cases.
Justice Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Wally Carson, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I my position is mentioned in the bill, so I appear here on Senate Bill 882, both in its original form and with its Dash 1 amendments, to offer my support for the bill. I think a question was raised because upon its passage and implementation, it requires the Chief Justice to sign off, and I'm certainly willing to do this, I think, again, depending on the memorandum of understanding, but this is a good idea, and it's continuing the efforts that Jefferson County particularly has been, and the Warm Springs have been working together over time with their judicial systems, and I'm pleased to say I support the bill. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Justice Carson. I appreciate your comments, support for the bill, and again, I apologize for the delay.
No, that's fine. I've been in that traffic once or twice myself, going the other way.
Thank you, sir.
And Chairman Minnis and Senators and Senator Farioli, my senator, appreciate you giving us a brief opportunity this morning. I just wanted to explain briefly what the current situation is. I'm a circuit court judge in Jefferson County, and I have been for the last 7 years. Prior to that, I was county judge in Jefferson County for 6 years, so I've dealt with juvenile in Jefferson County for the past 13 years. The Warm Springs Indian Reservation covers a number of counties, but the vast majority of their population lives in Jefferson County. Those youths that live in the Warm Springs Reservation go to school in Madras, which is off the reservation. They have family and friends often that live off the reservation. When tribally enrolled youth commit a delinquent act off the reservation, the Jefferson County Circuit Court has exclusive jurisdiction. During a typical year, about 200 cases are generated involving tribally enrolled youth that are referred through our juvenile court system. Members of both the Jefferson County Circuit Court and the Warm Springs Tribal Court have been meeting for years to talk about this classification of youth. We both have the consensus that some of these cases would be better dealt with in tribal court, and the reasons are numerous. Transportation barriers for court appearances, while always an issue, are particularly an issue with tribal members. A number of the parents of these youth do not have valid driver's license, and they're forced to make a decision whether to have their child appear in court or violate the law by driving them to court appearances. A number of these juveniles are already on probation in Warm Springs Tribal Court, and if we handle their cases, they're looking at duplicate services, duplicate probation officers. It's very difficult in our court system, even when we authorize the youth to receive their services in Warm Springs, to get those treatment providers to appear in our court for probation violation hearings and judicial reviews. As you know from running hearings, our court, although we try to be timely, it's not always right on time. So a 15-minute juvenile hearing would take a counselor away from community counseling in Warm Springs for as much as 2 hours by the time they drive from Warm Springs to Madras, wait for the hearing to take place, and then drive back to work. We also have an extreme difficulty in mandating appearance in our court with tribal youth. If a non-tribal member that doesn't appear at a juvenile court hearing, we can order sign a pickup order that authorizes our juvenile department to pick that youth up, and we can encourage compliance through that mechanism. Our pickup orders don't work on the Warm Springs Reservation. And this opportunity to develop a pilot project and develop a memorandum of understanding between our court and the tribal court will allow us to not only address the issues involving this youth population, but we feel it will open up the communications to deal with a number of issues involving our two communities. I know this wasn't scheduled for a lengthy hearing, and I don't want to go on beyond giving you that broad overview, but I would want to encourage that to give this pilot project an opportunity. I think the reason it's important, if you look at dependency cases, through ICWA, tribal members that live on the reservation, it's just the opposite. The tribal court has exclusive jurisdiction. So even if tribal members that come off the reservation come to our attention and we see this is a dependency case, we should get involved, we can't. The reason ICWA was passed is it recognizes that the tribe have an inherent interest in their future and their futures and their children. And certainly in these delinquency cases, and certainly in ones involving 10 and 11-year-old kids, in all actuality, although they're a delinquency case, they're treated much more like a dependency case. And it's just our feeling that the tribal system would be more appropriate to deal with some of those issues. The devil will be in the detail of the Memorandum of Understanding. It sunsets in July of 2006. It might take us that long to agree on the Memorandum of Understanding, because it certainly has a lot of issues to address, but we'd certainly like to have the opportunity to do that. Louis Pitt is here from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. If you want to ask him any questions concerning their desire to see this pass. I also brought a defense attorney, Jennifer Kimball, if you have any questions from the defense bar. And Matt Burney, our Jefferson County Juvenile Director, is here. And Peter Duell, our DA, is supportive of the bill but was unable to attend this morning.
Right. Thank you. Judge, thank you very much. Actually, it's unusual that we find a bill that everyone signs up in support of. So I think the other folks that came from more than 100, I'll give you an opportunity to say something if you want, but I directed counsel to schedule this for a work session next week. So I don't see it unless the committee has other concerns or questions. Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of quick observations. This bill was brought by Judge Ahern through the good offices of Chief Justice Corson in a series of meetings that we've been holding between the judicial branch of government and the legislative branch of government. And I just wanted to point out that those meetings do, in fact, help inform the legislative process about the needs and the objectives of the judiciary, and we were able to, in fact, trade some good information. I want to thank Ernest Mazarol for bringing the bill through the process to have it dropped in front of this committee. This issue isn't just about geographic diversity, although there's a great deal of difficulty, as Judge Ahern explained, in service of documents and retrieval of individuals for treatment by the court. It's also about cultural diversity. And the important part here is that youth at risk who are also Native American youth have a relevant identity in both the Native American world and in white culture. And here for the first time, we've got judicial administration of both these sovereign nations coordinating for the best interest of the child. It's not about the convenience of the court, and it's not about the geography of the area, although it covers many counties. It really is about making a decision about whether or not that youth will be better served by tribal justice courts and the decisions of the elders, or whether that youth will be better served by interfacing with the judiciary in Oregon's courts. And I think it's a really excellent partnership. And it strengthens both the tribal courts and the judicial justice courts, because everybody, for the first time, will be coordinated on the same page. And often I think there's somewhat of a tug-of-war between jurisdictional issues, and this illuminates that. So I just think this is one of those things that we can point to say, hey, great idea, let's just remove these obstacles and make this partnership work. Right. I want to thank these folks for bringing it.
Thank you, sir.
Great, thank you. Senator Walker, you have a question?
I do. Justice Carson? I think this is a fabulous idea. The thing that I would want to ask you is, in the original bill, it didn't delineate which tribe, and Oregon has 9 tribes, is my understanding. Why is it that we're just choosing the Warm Springs? And I assume it's a pilot project to see if it works, and then we'll expand it. But why did you focus on the Warm Springs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I'll defer the answer. I support it in its original form, which would apply across the state to our other tribal nations, but the Dash Ones limited it to the Warm Springs, which I also support. My understanding is that the Umatillas are interested in coming back in, but perhaps Judge Ahern can say why it was narrowed, because it is a pilot. Jefferson County, I think, is out in front of most other counties on the judicial side. And that may be the reason, but...
Senator Warren, I was basically nervous of getting support just for the pilot project and didn't want to bite off more than I was able to get. We've been talking for 13 years, I have, with the tribe. Obviously, when you involve other district attorneys who might not like the idea that a judge would have the authority to transfer a case to a tribe, we haven't had the chance to talk to the DAs that work with all the other tribes. We haven't had a chance to talk with all the other juvenile directors that would have to be involved with this. I think our court does have a very good working relationship with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and I'm not saying other judicial districts don't, but I don't know whether they do or not. And frankly, when we met with Senator Farioli and he told us what the timelines were to get a bill in and get a hearing before we were closed out, I would not have had the time to do what I think you should do, which is contact all of those people before we get moving. But I there's no reason it couldn't be duplicated elsewhere. And I mean, I think it will, hopefully, if the pilot project gets a chance at the end of that time, we can hold it up as a model that works. And if you want to have it be statewide initially, as long as it passes, I'd be all supporting of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, Judge Ahern. I appreciate your honesty in in terms of the fact that you haven't been able to get around to all of the tribes and DAs around the state, and that does take some time. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how this works, because I would very much like to extend it to the rest of the state. I think it's just a fabulous idea, and I wish you well, and hope by 2003 you're up and running enough that we can, or 2005, that we can offer something to the rest of the state.
We've got to go to the 2003 legislature.
Well, we're in 2003 yeah. Right now.
Do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Yes, Chairman Menace, Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, Louis Pitt, Jr., I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. We've submitted our speech to you. I think the partnership, as it is here with Judge Ahern, and is this pilot project is a matter of necessity for us, as pardon me, Commissioner Committee Man Ferrioli has stated, is that we love our kids and we want to take care of them. I'm going to deviate from the speech, and I think there's a part that's so important here is the children. And so with the I think one of the main things of us trying to protect ourselves is to protect that tribalism, that tradition, that culture, that strength that we have as the Indian people. And that's really, I think, one of the critical parts. And we will take care of our kids. And some of the parents don't like it. Some of the, you know, the responsibilities there. And so that's been the crux of this. We love our kids. And Judge Ahern hasn't told you the high responsibility that he has. He's married to a tribal member from Warm Springs, and we really respect, I think, the fact that with that energy and understanding that he has, is the solutions have been, I think, we understand and know right up front it's from a good heart. And so, again, strongly in support of Senate Bill 882, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. And as Judge Ahern has laid out, the reasoning for the Dash Ones with us is that we need to get on and continue the work that we've done with our children. And so in the timelines, again, as we understood, is that we needed to focus this on something that you would be able to handle. So we wouldn't be in favor of broadening it, as Senator Walker has stated, it'd be okay with us, is that, again, that we're going to focus in and do our best to try to push this bill through.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. I don't know if Ms. Kimball or is it Matthew?
Bernie,
if you want to say anything or not, since you did come quite a distance. And you're not traditional lobbyists either, so.
Chairman Menace, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Kimball. I'm an indigent defense service provider for the 22nd Circuit District. And I'm in support of this proposed amendment to the bill. The children that I deal with, and I probably have about 50 children a year who would be affected by this, have a great deal of reverence for the tribal court. Not that they don't respect the circuit court, but when I say to them, You also have a matter in tribal court, you know, their eyes get wide, and it's clear to me that it's very important to them to do well in the eyes of their tribal leaders and the court. And I think that by our courts having the opportunity to transfer certain cases up there, we're benefiting these children in a much greater way, and it allows them to have further contact with their own community and for their own community to know what problems these children are having. So as a defense attorney, I'm certainly in support of this. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Sir?
Chairman Menace, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Burney, Jefferson County Juvenile Department Director. Wanted to echo some of the support for this bill and maybe address the reasons that I support the amendment, as well as I know our district attorney supports the amendment as well. regarding the matter of the idea of a memorandum of understanding and formalizing the relations between the circuit court and the county juvenile system and the tribal system. Over the last 2 years, and 13 years as the judge says, but over the last 2 years we've really made some strides at the level of the agencies working with the youth to more closely collaborate and communicate, and a lot of that has gone very well, but there's not really any statutory authority for some of that. We do transfer some cases at intake to the tribal authorities, quite a few actually. Again, there's not really any statutory authority to do that. So some of this is just a codification of what's been happening and allowing us to go forward with more formal relations and to really in the MOU spell out responsibilities and commitments on both sides. So I see it as a tremendous benefit both to the circuit court, the county juvenile authorities, and the tribal authorities as well. And regarding the amendments, because as Judge Ahern said, the devil's in the details, I think it is important that there is a limited trial period and a limited scope to this trial, so that a model can be created, and that there's some order. And I know that many of the district attorneys in the state and also the juvenile directors had some concerns because they hadn't been working on this issue as we had, and it would be difficult clearly to get that kind of support. And I think the most appropriate action is with these amendments with us and our more advanced relations and work on this issue to be able to create a model, and then if it's successful as we intend and hope that it will be, to present that to the district attorneys, the juvenile directors, and others to garner more widespread support.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments by the committee?
Just to thank the chairman for allowing the hearing, and it's nice to see Justice Corson and Judge Ahern, and I appreciate Ernie Mazarol's support in bringing this to the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 882. We're going to do a quick traditional tap-tap hearing on Senate Bill 887. Council, what is that bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 887 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It deals with juvenile delinquency proceedings where the affirmative defense of mental disease or defect is raised. It sets out the procedures for that in delinquency cases and would set up a citizen review board for those youths once they've been adjudicated or there's been disposition with such a defense in place.
All right. Thank you. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 887. We're going to go to, I think, 801, if that's possible right now. So we'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill 801. And Council Basile.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 801 deals with divorce, separation, and annulment proceedings. It would provide a restraining order for the parties to such proceedings once the petition is served on the parties. As currently written, it would prohibit the parties from molesting, interfering, or harassing with each other. It would prohibit the parties from changing insurance policies, beneficiaries, for example. It would also prohibit parties from changing ownership of property. The measure would also apply to paternity petitions and would also have that same restraining order in effect, but in more limited. It would only be for the person that would molesting, interfering, or harassing with the parties and or disturbing the schedule of the child who is subject to the petition. Mr. Chairman, I was going to say I spoke to Senator Brown and I believe that we are going to be looking at some amendments to this. I want to let the committee know that.
All right. So is it Kamala Sugar? How do we pronounce that?
Kamala.
Kamala Sugar. There ought to be a law against difficult to pronounce names, or in my case, inability to pronounce names. Go ahead. Tell us what you want to tell us about this.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm an assistant district attorney in Lane County, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association.
Okay.
We're taking a neutral position on this bill with some concerns, and some of them were laid out, I think, in the testimony of the written testimony of Michael Yates, which I think the committee has. We just wanted to be sure that there would be no impact on district attorneys requiring them to enforce contempt of court criminally for any violations of these restraining orders. Under the FAFA restraining orders, we do enforce those. Those are domestic violence cases. We are happy to do those and feel that that's part of our role. However, we don't want to be involved in every potential contempt of court involved in a divorce case. In addition, we don't want the mandatory arrest law under 133055 to be invoked as part of these restraining orders. So I wanted to make sure that there was no intent in this bill for those two things to occur.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your testimony. Michael Yates. I don't know, Senator Brown, do you want to testify on this particular bill, Senator Brown, or not? No.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Michael Yates. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I'm a six-member law firm. We limit our practice to domestic relations, and I have been so limited for 20 years. I am currently the president of the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners, which we refer to ourselves as OFLAP. We've been around since 1994. We are a nonprofit, as we call ourselves, a mutual benefit corporation. We primarily do the following. We have social meetings. We have continuing legal education seminars that we ourselves organize, sponsor, with the idea of promoting, expanding, improving the education and practice of family law practitioners for our members. We're about 100 members strong. We have also sponsored law students from a couple of the law schools to attend family law functions. We also provide charitable contributions to some deserving organizations, such as the St. Andrew Legal Clinic, which is a nonprofit public interest law firm in the Portland area. We asked Senator Brown to sponsor this legislation. Committee Council has correctly, I think, or accurately summarized. Let me first comment on the concerns of the district attorneys by Ms. Sugar. There's nothing, in our view, in the language of the bill, and certainly in our intent, that would any way call into play the criminal justice system. Any violation of, say, the property restraint provisions, or any violation of the status quo protective order restraint provisions with respect to children, would call into play only possible civil contempt, which would be brought by the litigants or their attorneys. And if, in speaking with Ms. Sugar beforehand, OFLAC would be amenable to any clarifying language to make it certain, in case there is any concern, that this would not involve district attorneys and the criminal justice system. The idea here is we all want to promote good behavior and discourage bad behavior. And unfortunately, when people, even very good people, go through a divorce proceeding, they often let their emotions get the best of them, and they engage in bad or questionable behavior. The bill basically has two thrusts. One, that upon the filing of a petition, the court would provide forms that would enter an order automatically freezing the disposition of assets, preventing a party from canceling or affecting any kind of insurance, changing the beneficiaries of life insurance, and also a non-interference or non-molestation provision. If a party objected to any one of those provisions, then they could request a hearing. The second part of the legislation deals with children. Unfortunately, they are, as some of the committee members may know, pawns in the emotional conflict that's engendered by divorce. We have found in our experience that there are more and more people who are not represented by attorneys. The number of pro se litigants is ballooning, and therefore they're not able to, through attorneys, avail themselves of current statutory provisions that allow the court, upon application before a judge, to enter a protective order of restraint with respect to children. Therefore, we've tried to carefully lay out provisions that, where children are involved in a divorce proceeding or in a paternity proceeding, the court would automatically enter a status quo order, a protective order of restraint. And Section 2, Subsection 4A, lays out what the terms of that protective order of restraint would be. In discussing this part of the bill with interested parties, and OFLAB admits that this part of the bill has caused the most interest, if not difficulty, there may be some further amendments that we would want to consider to clear up the language and perhaps make it more clear. Finally, a word about the further intent of OFLAP. It is not the intent of OFLAP or this legislation to have any impact whatsoever on a party's or person's ability to get either a Family Abuse Act restraining order, known as a FAPA, or a stalking order. Some interested parties have expressed concern that, for instance, because the court enters this non-molestation order, that would somehow give a judge an excuse or reason not to enter, under appropriate circumstances, a FAPA order or a stalking order. We want to be clear that this legislation is to have no impact on one's ability to obtain those kinds of orders. And again, if necessary, OFLAP would be willing to consider appropriate amendments to make that intent or to assuage those concerns.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wong.
Thank you. Mr. Yates, I don't know, maybe it's just my background, but I really don't like the use of the word molestation in this context. Is there, it denotes a sexual sort of thing to me, and I don't think that's what your intent is. Is there some other word in the vernacular that you use?
Chairman Minister, Senator Walker raises a good question. That language, molesting, interfering, or harassing, was lifted from the current language of ORS 107.095. I would agree with you that the term molesting is, as in current usage, is somewhat dated. However, under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which I refer to as FAPA, in 107.705.7, molest, Senator Walker, is defined as an act with hostile intent or injurious effect in a manner that would reasonably be expected to annoy, disturb, or persecute a person in the petitioner's position. So molest has a clearly defined legal sense here, as opposed to the sense that you have a more common or vernacular usage.
Okay, I'll just be satisfied with that. I don't like it. And I also want to commend you, Mr. Yates, for being a Domrel attorney for so many years. One of the judges I worked for said he couldn't get out of the business fast enough. So thank you for servicing Oregonians in need.
That's why the chair has a reluctance to even hear these kind of bills. Drives you nuts. Go ahead,
Ken. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Yates, I wanted to ask a follow-up question. Were any concerns raised by any parties on having language that follows the FAPA order in this bill when there's no need to prove any of prior abuse or any imminent danger?
Committee counsel, are you referring to the language in Section 2, subparagraph 3A?
Correct.
The concern, as I understand it, is that the concerned parties don't want this legislation to any way dilute or diminish one's ability to obtain relief under the FAPA statutes or stalking. I don't think I heard any concern about the particular language. I don't know if that answered your question.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up question.
Go ahead.
Mr. Yates, my concern was that in our current law that you would have to show a pattern of prior abuse to have such a restraining order, correct, under FAPA? And was there a concern that there's no such requirement.
That's right. Interested parties have expressed concern with respect to Section 2, subparagraph 3A, or subsection 3A, that it may not be advisable to automatically enter such, you know, non-contact molestation order. And we have heard those concerns, and in some respect, they are well-founded.
All right. Asking counsel if the language that appears there and the fact that this would be an automatic restraining order, even though it's not intended to be a stalking order or a FAPA order, would it be prejudicial to a respondent? If this occurs during a divorce proceeding, the fact that this is an automatic restraining order, does that prejudice the respondent in a stalking order or a FAPA order, since it already has similar language?
Chairman Minnis, my answer to that would be no, and some suggestions have been made that we would include language that made clear that any orders entered under the stalking section or a FAPA order would take precedence or preempt, if you will, any order, be it with respect to the children or with respect to molesting and interfering under this legislation.
Right.
We believe that's the case now anyway. So
I know, and I think the thing that we've run into from time to time is unless we make it explicit and very clear, judges will say we either don't have the authority or we're bound to do the following, and so I want to make sure that we're not doing something, what is it, unintended consequences or having an effect that we don't desire. So, all right.
Appreciate your comments, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Brown, we have a 9:15 time certain, I think. Is that flexible?
It is flexible, that's my understanding.
All right, let me get Sybil Hebb on this bill, and we can close the public hearing on this bill. Good morning, Sybil.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm a family law attorney with the Oregon Law Center's State Support Unit. As you may know, the Law Center provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians, and a large bulk of our cases are family law cases. I've practiced solely within the area of family law for the last 7 years. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Law Center and its clients to present three concerns about Senate Bill 801. Of course, we have nothing but respect for the proponents of the bill and their intent in proposing automatic terms of restraint on family law litigants. And we believe that the financial terms of restraint as proposed by the bill would have a very positive impact on parties and in preserving the security of parties going through these proceedings. We do have some concerns about the terms of restraint that would apply to people rather than property, and I'll briefly outline those. The concern that we have about the terms of restraint that would automatically apply to the status of children are threefold. One is that currently Oregon law provides for the ability to obtain a temporary protective order of restraint with respect to children in a way that admittedly is not part of the normal dissolution procedure paperwork, but is a fairly easy process. There's paperwork available on the Judicial Department's website, and those proceedings are free to file. They're fairly easy to fill out, and we have seen parties able to achieve that relief fairly easily. The benefit that the current statutory provisions for protective orders of restraint with respect to kids offers over the proposals that are proposed in Senate Bill 801 is that the current law requires that a party asking for this relief give some indication as to what the status quo of the children is at the time of filing, and it requires that the court look at a three-month period. And I think that goes towards achieving the purpose of what I assume to be the purpose of this bill as well, of providing some constancy for children going through these procedures. If Senate Bill 801 were to pass without requiring that the court look at sort of a broader snapshot than just the initial moment of filing, we're concerned that would lead to an unintended consequence of sort of freezing the status of the children at the exact moment of filing, which may be very different from what the children had experienced over, you know, the most recent period of time. As well, the bill would, as written, require the court to preserve the place of residence and the children's daily schedule. And I would submit to the committee, and this is also a concern with current law, but the place of residence is far less important to a child than is the daily routine and the time that the child spends with both parents. And so I would encourage this committee to consider whether the court whether the bill could address the idea of providing constancy for children by looking at a larger sort of section of the child's history and preserving the time that the child spends with parents and the schedule as opposed to the place of residence at the and the route the schedule that existed right at the time of filing. We're concerned that would encourage a race to the courthouse and provide inappropriate advantages to the first party to file. The other concern that I have related to those particular provisions are that because the terms place of residence or daily routine are not defined in Senate Bill 801, there's not a lot of I'm not sure what the benefit would be to parties who file this and then receive an order, but there's no definition as to what is the routine that the parties are required to adhere to. And I think parties who are unable to come to an agreement on their own would be sort of left to accuse one another of violations or try to, you know, figure out what the routine was or that the court was protecting. And especially since my background is representing people who are low income, the vast majority of whom are not able to afford legal counsel and who our offices are not able to assist for lack of funding reasons, we're worried that people without legal counsel would have to seek access or recourse through the courts, and that would provide a number of hearings. As well, the current provisions of law require that a hearing be held within 14 to 21 days if one party believes that the other party has misrepresented the status quo or that the order preserves something inappropriately. This particular bill would not provide for any such quick hearing, and our concern is that it would leave children in the midst of uncertainty in a way that's unintended. So those are the concerns with respect to the provisions that would apply to children. My concerns with respect to the provisions that would apply to parties and that would impose automatic terms of restraint, I think get at some of the concern or at the question raised by counsel. I believe that if orders of restraint are entered automatically without requiring any submission of evidence that there is the need for such an order, without any submission of evidence that there has been abuse or that there's the potential for abuse by one party or another, there are two dangers that follow from that. And one is that if parties who don't have any concerns related to harassment or interference, parties who are getting along well have these terms imposed on them automatically, my concern is that it could create conflict and sort of throw parties into a more divisive and embattled procedure. Aside from that, my concern is that very frequently and unfortunately, there are a large number of people for whom the threat of abuse is very real and very current, and it's appropriate in those circumstances for the court to enter a term of restraint to protect a party or children. I believe that if these orders are entered automatically, regardless of whether there is a need, that it sort of undermines the protective purposes of the procedures that are in place right now to address abuse when it does exist. So we would advocate that the terms of restraint remain at the court's discretion and be entered upon a showing of need the way that they are currently administered. I'll be quick. With respect to the financial terms and the property terms of restraint, we're very supportive of that. I think the bill's well crafted there and provides some important exceptions and some important guidance to parties, and that would preserve the net equitable distribution of assets. I had one suggestion about that, which is that the term in section 2(3) sub D sort of indicates that parties should not spend assets or use property except for the normal course of business or the necessities of life. It seems to me that it would be appropriate to sort of further define those terms to provide some more understanding between the parties. And again, because of the fact that many victims of domestic violence in separation circumstances are facing greater danger than they may have at other times in the period of the relationship. Frequently, a victim may need to, for example, move or establish a new residence or may have safety concerns that are necessary, and I would advocate that some sort of safety concern for domestic violence survivors be one of the exceptions to the financial terms of restraint. So thank you very much for allowing me to share my concerns.
Any other questions, comments?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Comments, Senator Walker.
I want to thank Ms. Hebb for your testimony today. It was very instructive, raised some of the issues and concerns that I have with the bill, and it was just right on target. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Brown. Do you want to? I assume you want to work on this thing.
Yes.
You clearly understand all the testimony so far and the issues of the party. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown, I think there are a number of issues that we need to address. I just wanted to make sure that folks understood in terms of the property restraining orders that in cases where there are attorneys, it's fairly common practice, and in cases where child custody was an issue, the status quo order is also fairly common practice. Mr. Yates tells me about half the time. So this is not something new and different. My understanding from talking to Nancy Miller is that in 80% of the family law cases, at least one party is represented by a lawyer. I think, no offense to the lawyers in the room, but I do think with legal fees increasing, that may change, that number may change. But I think there are a number of issues we can work on from Section Sub 3A, the restraining order language regarding harassment of either party, and obviously we will look at the whole child status quo order, whether that is appropriate given the fiscal concerns that raises.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We'll wait to hear back from you when you think you're ready. All right. We have some testimony. We're going to close the public hearing at 8:01, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 621. And then we have Mr. Kramer, who hopefully is done with his deposition.
Here it goes.
This is the Senate Judiciary Committee calling for Mr. Kramer. Mr. Chairman, while the Secretary is getting Mr. Kramer, Senate Bill 621 is related to written agreements for adoptive parents, and it would expand it so that the parties could enter into an... Mr. Kramer, Craig Prinz, I'm the administrator for the Senate Judiciary Committee. You're on the line here, and I was just explaining Senate Bill 621, which expands who can enter into a written agreement regarding continuing contact with a child who has been adopted. Would it include birth relatives? It would expand it from birth parents to birth relatives, which is defined as parents, grandparents, siblings, and other members of the child's birth family.
All right, Mr. Kramer, Senator Venice here. Chair, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you'd like to tell us about the bill, why it's necessary.
What this
bill would do is to allow birth relatives to be a party to a contract between prospective adopted parents and themselves, which would allow for post-adoption contact. Right now, birth relatives can be part of such agreement, but they cannot be parties to the agreement. Therefore, they cannot enforce the agreement. The law, the Senate Bill 621, makes no change in the current law, which requires absolutely that the prospective adoptive parents agree. It makes no change in the current law, which permits the agreement to be modified or terminated if required in the best interest of the children. How the situation comes about on a fairly regular basis is that grandparents, aunts, uncles, or other birth relatives have had a child in foster care or in relative care for many years until the time is to adopt the child. Once an adoption is done, if there is not a provision made for post-adoption contact, there is no legal right of the relative to do so. The problem is that a child has developed a many-year bonded relationship with this third party that, in many cases, is the best interest of the child to continue. When we get to the point of the relatives, grandparents, aunts, uncles, etc., deciding whether to seek adoption or whether to release the child to usually a non-relative family, they're between a rock and a hard place. Do we do what we think is best for the child and allow them to grow up with a new family because we're not able to be a permanent placement? And in doing so, do we ever give up any contact with this child? Or to maintain contact with this child, do we pursue an adoption even though we don't think we're either physically, emotionally, or otherwise prepared to have this child on a permanent basis? This is the key that resolves that dilemma because it permits us to negotiate with prospective adoptive parents, and if it's a DHS case, with the assistance of the caseworker to seek an open adoption. In some cases, the contact will be as little as a letter and photographs each year. In some cases, the contact can be as much as a weekend, a month, and a week during the summer. It all depends upon what the prospective adoptive family and the relative family negotiate. So I have conferred with a number of members of the bar and a number of judges and a number of DHS caseworkers. No one has told me that this is a bad idea. Everybody has told me that it's a good idea, and I urge you to support it.
All right, Mr. Kramer, thank you very much. I don't know if you want to remain on the line and listen to the testimony from the Department of Human Resources.
I would appreciate doing so because I've not heard I've not had formal contact with DHS.
Right.
That's because they may not have been aware that I'd asked Senator Brown to have this bill prepared.
All right. Senator Brown, would you want Ms. McFarland to come up now and then do DHS?
Great. Great. And yes. Mr. Chair, just for Mr. Kramer's benefit, since he's not here, I just wanted to know that his testimony has been distributed under cover letter from my office. Excuse me.
All right. So we do have your written testimony. All right. Julie McFarland, Juvenile Rights Project. You would just state your name for the record and then proceed.
Certainly. Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I have been at the Juvenile Rights Project for the past 25 years. We represent children in juvenile court in Multnomah and other counties.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Certainly. And we represent children specifically in termination of parental rights cases that are the case precedents to adoption cases. We represent them both in cases that have been filed by the district attorney, and we file those cases ourselves on behalf of our child clients. Open adoption agreements are about the only successful way of settling those cases, and they are very difficult and very costly cases. And one of the reasons that the cost to the state for these cases is kept down is because there is a high settlement rate of them. These cases are kind of like the cases, the saying about litigation, it's something you go into as a pig and come out as a sausage because they're lengthy and they really put the individual parents on trial and basically are trying to show that what a bad person they are because they're unable to parent their child. So we think that having open adoption agreements broadly available is in the best interest of children, but then it's definitely financially to the advantage of the state. Most often, those open adoption agreements are between the adoptive parents and the parent, but it is not unusual that the primary person in the child's life before the case came to juvenile court was not the parent but another relative, typically grandparent. And so both the child has an interest in having a continuation of that relationship, and the parent who has the right to settle the case or not settle the case will be saying things like, I want my mom to be able to continue to see her granddaughter. And I'm not going to settle this case unless that happens. So this bill would allow that to happen in a formal way that's sufficiently satisfactory to parents that they would be able to settle it. I know that DHS has raised a number of concerns, and the little handout that you have from us addresses some of those. And just briefly, the change sought is permissive so that it will be up to the court, up to the adoptive parents, whether or not to enter into the open adoption agreements. They are voluntary. Mediation services, which are effective in getting parents often to agree to open adoption and to settle termination of parental rights cases, are not required by statute or policy to be provided to relatives, and many times we have negotiated open adoption agreements without the services of a mediator, with the attorneys basically doing that. Before we had mediators, that's how it happened, is that the attorneys representing the children, the state, and so forth would negotiate those. So it's not the concern about expense is not a necessary concern, and the agency can simply decide that they are not going to provide mediation in relative cases. I think, and then there's a few other points that you can look at in the little sheet that we handed out, and I would urge the committee to support this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions of Mr. Parham? There are none. Thank you. All right. Kathy, is it Ledesma? I'm really good at butchering names today.
There ought to be a law against
that. I know, there ought to be. But that might not stop me. All right. Kathy, go ahead, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I am the program manager for adoption services at the Department of Human Services, and I am here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 621. As you know, the bill modifies ORS 109-305 subsection 2 as it relates to adoptions. The bill changes a single word, birth parents, to birth relatives, and in so doing doesn't change the intent of the law. I was also interested, straying a bit here from my prepared testimony, to hear Mr. Kramer say prospective adoptive parents, that is not a change that is proposed by this bill, and prospective adoptive parents I don't believe is in the current statute. ORS 109-305-2 was adopted in 1993 by this body in connection with a DHS pilot project, which demonstrated that more satisfactory outcomes for all members of the adoption triad, meaning the child, the adoptive parents, and the birth parents, could be obtained through the use of specially trained mediators to develop written agreements for communication after the finalization of adoptions. When these agreements are incorporated into the adoption decree under statute, the written agreement becomes legally enforceable by civil action, and that's in subsection 4 of the statute. In current practice, non-parent birth relatives of children adopted out of DHS foster care And I do want to just state for the committee that currently approximately one-third of all adoptions that occur in the state of Oregon are of children out of DHS foster care, and that's been so for the last 2 years. And in over the past 2 years, so calendar year 2001, calendar year 2002, we referred made 613 referrals for adoption mediation on behalf of 928 children to the cost at the cost of $1.1 million. So in current practice, non-birth parent relatives of children adopted out of foster care are often included in adoptive planning, including continuing contact after finalization of the child's adoption. And this does take one of two forms. In the first, if the non-parent relative actually applied to adopt the child but was not identified as the family in which the child's needs would best be met on a permanent basis, we voluntarily, DHS voluntarily offers mediation services between the non-parent birth relative and the adoptive family. And as a matter of fact, we are the ones who suggest that. Unlike a mediated agreement between the child's birth parent and the adoptive parent under current statute, this agreement is not incorporated into the child's adoption decree and is therefore not legally binding under this statute. However, in consultation with our legal counsel, under Oregon contract law, those agreements may be legally enforceable. And since we prepared this rather quickly and didn't have a chance to really get into contract law, which is not our area of expertise, I think that Department of Justice would be should be included in that conversation. A second way for a child's non-parent birth relative to be included in plans for post-finalization communication is for the child's birth parents and adoptive parents to include in their agreement a provision for specific types of communication with the birth relatives at specific intervals. And I do want to tell you that in actual practice that does occur very frequently, but it does rely on a good relationship between the birth parents and their family members who want to have continuing contact. DHS opposes Senate Bill 621 for the following reasons. First of all, because the term relatives is not defined in this statute, an almost limitless number of relatives in some cases might seek agreements. This has a workload impact on DHS that is not in the governor's recommended budget. I make an analogy to what happens when we include relatives in planning in family decision meetings for children and want to look at relatives as prospective adoptive parents for children. When we look at one relative and that relative is not suitable or the child would not fit well into that family, we sometimes end up with a limitless number of relatives. Well, if not Aunt Susie, then Uncle Joe. And in some cases, in very large families, that can significantly delay the achievement of permanency on a timely basis. On average, each mediation referral takes 24 clock hours of professional mediation time, and each agreement is mediated separately. So if there's one parent, if there's two parents, one child, that's two separate mediations. Therefore, an expansion to relatives could result in delays to achieve adoption within the federally mandated timelines and according to the time standards that DHS reports to the Oregon Joint Legislative Ways and Means Committee and also to the federal government. Adoptive parents are sometimes reluctant to agree to mediation even with the child's parents. The prospect of being asked to engage in mediation with multiple relatives may discourage some prospective adoptive families from adopting at all. There is an unknown safety factor with relatives, and whereas DHS will know what potential risk to safety of the child is posed by the child's birth parents, the statute, as modified to include relatives, doesn't provide for a means to verify the safety of the child with his or her relatives. There's no provision in Senate Bill 621 for additional funding to verify relative safety, and any additional funding suggested would not be in the governor's recommended budget. providing a means for a child to maintain safe and healthy relationships with members of his birth family, even when the family's not able to permanently parent him, really is good child welfare practice, and in most cases is viewed by adoption and mental health professionals as positive. Oregon was the first and continues to be one of the only, and very possibly the only, state that makes written agreements between birth parents and adoptive parents legally binding when they are incorporated into the adoption decree. To the best of our knowledge, however, no state has extended this ability to non-parent relatives. In summary, DHS opposes Senate Bill 621, not because it's not good child welfare practice, but because of its potential for delaying the adoptions of children from foster care and for making such adoptions more costly. I would also add that when we're looking at shifting costs from voluntary agreements to release children for adoption and litigating the termination of parental rights, we don't terminate the parental rights. We don't go through a trial to terminate the rights of relatives. So it really is an added cost, not less cost, because we would not, in lieu of developing agreements between the non-parent birth relatives and the adoptive parents, we would not be avoiding a more costly trial to terminate those relatives' rights, as we are when we mediate an agreement between the birth parents, whose rights are to be terminated voluntarily or involuntarily, and the adoptive parents. Thanks for the opportunity to testify about Senate Bill 621. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions, Senator Brown?
Thank you, Senator Burdick, Madam Vice Chair. A couple of questions. Kathy, would you agree with me that in a significant or at least a portion of these cases where children are under the custody of DHS, that the relationships between family members and the birth parents is somewhat troubled or tense or difficult?
Senator Burdick, Senator Brown, I can't really cite a number there. What we do in actual practice and under the statute is that we do have family meetings where we try to identify and we ask the parents to identify any available birth relatives. The onus really is on the parents to identify for us. And I do want to cite that since we've begun to do that, the percentage of children who are adopted by their birth relatives has risen, I would almost use the word astronomically. We're now about 35% of children, about a third of our children are adopted by birth relatives.
Madam Vice Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
Let's go back to a situation where grandparents have taken on a grandchild in foster care under ASFA. It's not likely to last longer than 2 years, but let's say the grandparents have had this child for 2 years. They have been determined by the agency not to be an appropriate placement for adoption. If the child is adopted by a non-relative family, those grandparents then have no legal rights other than the potential contract agreement that you talked about. Is that correct?
Senator Burdick, Senator Brown, that is right under the current statute. And we do, in practice, as I stated, almost invariably refer that for mediation, ask the adoptive parents if they would be willing to let the grandparents continue to be the grandparents, and we do a mediated agreement. But again, under the current statute, it doesn't have the legal enforceability that the other agreements have. You're absolutely right.
Okay. One more. You've expressed concern about the fiscal, but as I read the bill, this is totally voluntarily, Terry, and nothing mandates you to work with birth relatives in terms of helping construct these agreements. So if you are concerned about a fiscal, as I read the bill, there's nothing that requires you to do this. Is that correct?
Senator Burdick, Senator Brown, That's right, and there's nothing under the current statute that requires us to offer the program that we currently offer for birth parents. However, in actual practice, we often have it suggested to us by the Citizen Review Board in the form of a recommendation, or we often have it suggested to us by a judge that we should be offering this service to birth parents. And when that happens, we almost always do that. And so having relatives added to the statute really is a small leap to having then that become a suggestion to us from the bench that we provide that service. So that is, it is our concern in this time of restricted funding.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 621.
Mr. Kramer, I'm going to hang up now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer.
Thank you for your guest appearance.
Thank you.
Provided
a real service to Senate Judiciary this morning.
Thanks.
Thanks
for
your
indulgence.
Okay, in the interest of time, we are going to open a hearing on two bills. Senate Bill 808 and Senate Bill 809. The same witnesses are signed up for both of them. They are Julie McFarland from the Juvenile Rights Project and Kevin George from the Department of Human Services. Why don't you both come on up, and we'll start with counsel to describe the bills, and then we'll have Julie speak and then Kevin speak on both Senate Bill 808 and 809, just in the interest of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chairwoman. This is two bills, Senate Bill 808. This deals with suspending commitment in a dependency case. When there's a child who is turned 18 and wants to try to live independently, rather than ending DHS jurisdiction or commitment to DHS, this bill would allow the court to suspend that and then reinstate it if it's in the best interest of the child. I think the idea is give independent living a chance. If it doesn't work out, there's no gap. It can go right back into it. Senate Bill 809, this is a bill that also deals with suspension of commitment, but this deals with DHS and OIA and the interplay between those two. When a youth is a dependent child and then is also placed in the custody of OIA on a different matter, perhaps, then this would have that same situation of suspending the DHS and then having OIA and DHS communicate about changes in that youth's life.
Okay. Thank you, Wilson. And I, again, in the interest of time, would ask you to keep your comments very brief, but we'll start with Julie McFarland. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Furtick and members of the committee. This is Julie McFarlane. I'm senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I think it's very appropriate to hear both of these bills together because they do involve the same issue, which is children who have been in the custody of the state, who are wards of the court, aging out, getting ready to be emancipated and on their own, and what happens to them both when they've had a detour into OIA, into the delinquency system, and when they've basically grown up in foster care. And for the last year and a half, I have been working on a special project where I have had a lot of contact with children and people who work with them who are in the foster care system. And it has become very apparent to me that there are a lot of concerns about children who are aging out of foster care in Oregon. And I supplied some fairly extensive written testimony, which talks about the outcomes for those young people, which are significantly less advantageous than the outcomes for children in the general population in terms of accomplishing high school graduation, in terms of being employed, staying out of the mental health system, staying out of the criminal justice system, and in terms of being homeless. So we have children who are basically our children, the state's children, who are ending up having very poor outcomes, and we believe that this could be improved by these bills. First of all, in 808, there's a significant new provision which would require that the transition plans for these youth be reviewed as part of the regular court reviews that are already being conducted on these children, and CRB reviews, Citizen Review Board reviews as well. And these children's cases are reviewed anyway, approximately every 6 months. Many of the issues for transition are looked at and discussed in the court hearing, and by having the transition plans, which are part of the plan, permanency planning that DHS is required to do, also be part of those hearings, we will have a better, more comprehensive look at what the youth needs in order to successfully transition to adulthood. The second piece of 808 then is to allow a trial emancipation period, where, and we very often see, basically I think there are two kinds of kids that I see who are in foster care. Kids who say to me, I'm never leaving, which of course is kind of unrealistic too, and then the kids who say at 16, 17, 18, I want out of here now, and who will do everything they can to get out, and then too often decide after they're out there on their own that this is really a lot more difficult than they thought it was going to be. And in very many cases for those kids, another plan can be developed. There can be a voluntary plan. They can go into independent living services so that they still basically are remaining emancipated, but they're getting some supports from the agency. But in some cases, it's just not appropriate. They really need to be back in foster care. And this would give the court the ability to do that in what we think are a small number of cases.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? You're next. Mr. George.
Good morning. Chairman Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I'm the foster care program manager for children, adults, and families at the Oregon Department of Human Services. Department of Human Services is unable to support Senate Bill 808 because it has a fiscal impact that is not in the governor's recommended budget. Senate Bill 808 has two primary statutory changes that Ms. McFarlane spoke to, and we anticipate having an effect on youth in our foster care system. The first statutory change requires the court, during dependency hearing, to review the comprehensive plan for a child's transition to independence. Currently, the court's review requires the department to identify the permanency plan for children and youth, and this requirement may not include the court's comprehensive review of the transition plan,
a review. Could I interrupt you, please? We have your written testimony. Could you summarize, because we're running
absolutely
short on
absolutely
time. Thank you.
At Senate Bill 808, the department really believes that there's two pieces. One piece, we believe it is good practice for the court to review a comprehensive plan, which is not consistent across the state at this point in time. The review of plan, yes, the child is to emancipate, and they may not go any further than that. So we do support the good public policy of reviewing a comprehensive plan, and that the department then would put that forward. The piece on the number of youth that could potentially sign themselves back in or voluntarily come back into the foster care system would be a new population of kids for us, our young adults between 18 and 21. For the most part, the department works with youth under the age of 18, and at 18, then they emancipate out. We anticipate that the number of kids that we would be serving would be, again, a best shot estimate, around 8% of the kids that may qualify could potentially sign themselves back in. And we've built that assumption based on some of the voluntary services we have right now. For those youth that were in the foster care system during their teenage years, they are eligible for some independent living skills training. And that skills training is money management, budgeting, housing, those kind of activities. They also then, if a child ages out of the foster care system, meaning that they had a birthday cake that said happy 18th birthday on the table in the foster home, they then are eligible for some federal CHAPE housing assistance. And that allows them some housing support coupled with the skills training. So that population of kids have some of those services, and it's all on a voluntary basis on that youth. So at this point, we support the fact that the public policy is good, a review and a comprehensive plan, and cannot support Senate Bill 808 based on the budget impact we believe that's written in the testimony.
Thank you.
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. George, in Ms. McFarland's testimony, in her written testimony, she says on page 4 that DHS already requires that all youth in DHS foster care will have a plan for independence developed at or before the age of 16. In practice, however, a transition plan is rarely seen in DHS files, and it is not included in reviews of the youth's case. And I've just heard you testify that this is available, but it's not practiced across the state. Could you explain why the department is not doing their duty to help these children?
Chairman Burdick and Senator Walker, I believe it's actually a twofold or two-pronged question you have there. One is what I testified to is that the court is not routinely reviewing a comprehensive plan to really hold the department accountable to say, what is the plan, more than saying this child is going to emancipate or this child is going to go live on their own, but to say, and what are you doing, what activities are you going to be doing, are you providing this youth some educational support, mentoring, is there a plan over the next 90 days, a thorough review of what that plan is. And I think that is our responsibility to bring that forward. The development of an independent living plan has been a piece that's been in our policy and practice for a long time. And I will say, quite honestly, we are not real good at that yet. And this has been a piece that Ms. McFarland, her office, as well as the department, has been discussing over the last couple of years to say, great, it's great to have the notion that a plan will be developed. What does that plan look like? And what should be in that plan? And we've got some activities underway right now in the department about what those plans would develop into for children, or for youth.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand what this bill is trying to get at. I don't know that I want to keep children in the foster care system until they're 21 or 25, but it's been clear to me in the testimony today that the department has failed in its duties with regard to developing plans for foster children, and I'm just very disturbed about the testimony I've heard today, and I'd like a little more information from the department as to why they're being dilatory in their duties.
Further questions? Did you
want to
testify separately on
809
or your comments?
Absolutely. I provided written testimony as well for Senate Bill 809, and so I will summarize that as well based on the chair's recommendation. Senate Bill 809, again, the department is unable to support this bill because it is not in the governor's balanced budget. What this bill, in essence, does is suspends the commitment to the Department of Human Services while the youth is committed to Oregon Youth Authority. Once that commitment is done with Oregon Youth Authority, then the courts would have the ability to recommit the child to the Department of Human Services for foster care services within our agency. This broadens the scope of the kids that were the youth that would be served. Currently, the mechanism is in place for OA to have a commitment terminated on a child. If the court approves that, the court can then assign dependency back to the Department of Human Services at this point in time if the child is under 18. Those children or youth that are between 18 and 21, the dependency court does not have a mechanism at this point in time to assign those kids back to the department because at that point in time they're considered emancipated and therefore no longer fall under the dependency courts. This bill would allow that court to suspend the commitment to Department of Human Services and then recommit those kids back, even if they were 19, 19 and a half years old, to come back in the department foster care system, of which is a piece and a caseload that we currently are not serving. And so therefore, the department believes that the impact will be, we assess about 11 children could potentially come back in a given year, and in written testimony I provided the fiscal impact of what that would be. There is also a letter that was to be submitted from the Oregon Youth Authority, Karen Bruzeau, that I believe you should have as well.
Do you know if that was in opposition or in support of this?
That's not in support. Chair Burdick, it's a brief letter. I have a copy of it. I could read it to the committee.
I believe copies are coming from the department or Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 808 and 809. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Right here, Program Improvement Plan, OAR. Right.